secret operations it considered to be traditional military activities. The law offered little guidance as to what constituted traditional military activities, partly because the George H.W. Bush White House and Pentagon had successfully lobbied Congress to keep the language vague. These activities were ultimately defined as any operations carried out by the military that were connected to ongoing or anticipated hostilities. In other words, the Pentagon could justify sending troops to any country in the world if it could make the case that the United States was at war inside that country, or might be at some point in the future. These arcane provisions were little discussed for a decade, until the days after the September 11 attacks, when Congress gave President Bush a sweeping mandate to wage war all over the globe. According to the provisions of the Authorization for Use of Military Force, or AUMF, the United States was not at war with any one particular country, but at war in any country where Al-Qaeda was operating. The measure, in effect, gave Rumsfeld the license he was looking for to carry out a global war. Still, it took time for the Defense Secretary to exploit these new powers. Not long after the fall of Kabul in late 2001, the energies of senior leaders at the Pentagon turned almost immediately to planning for an invasion of Iraq. And beyond the Al-Qaeda safe havens like Pakistan, the Pentagon had difficulty figuring out where else the United States could hunt Al-Qaeda. In the counterterrorism vernacular, the requirement was to find, fix, and finish terrorists. But as Rumsfeld would admit years later, we had the ability to finish. We just couldn't find and fix things. Rumsfeld and his team were feeling quite sure of themselves during the first half of 2003. The invasion of Iraq had seemed, at first, to confirm much of Rumsfeld's vision for a new way of war. The march to Baghdad that had lasted barely a month was conducted with a relatively small invasion army, testing the Defense Secretary's philosophy that advances in technology, twinned with a war plan that emphasized speed over muscle, could win the wars of the 21st century. His skepticism about the CIA's intelligence had also led him, the year before the invasion, to set up a small shop at the Pentagon, overseen by Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas J. Feith, to sift through raw intelligence to prove that Saddam Hussein was in league with Islamic terrorists. Once American troops had reached Baghdad, many of Rumsfeld's aides had convinced themselves it was only a matter of time before they would find definite proof of a link between Hussein and Osama bin Laden and a post facto justification for the invasion. Ultimately, American troops found no such evidence, and the conclusions of Rumsfeld's intelligence shop were largely discredited. But with Saddam Hussein gone and the administration divided about whether Syria ought to be the next target of the Bush administration's regime change strategy, Rumsfeld's planning for the global special operations war intensified. Robert Andrews had left the Pentagon, and Rumsfeld replaced him with Thomas O'Connell, another veteran of the paramilitary wars of Vietnam and a former Grey Fox commander. O'Connell had deployed to Vietnam in 1970 as a military advisor to the Phoenix program. The controversial CIA-led campaign to turn the tide of the war by capturing and assassinating Viet Cong leaders. He had spent most of his adult life in the special operations and intelligence world, and he had been JSOC's top intelligence officer when Representative Dick Cheney visited the command in 1986. His job interview with Rumsfeld had gone particularly well, mostly because O'Connell's views on the Pentagon's authorities and the role of special operations troops were exactly what Rumsfeld wanted to hear. "If we're at war, why do I have to put my people under CIA authority?" Rumsfeld asked O'Connell early on during the meeting. You don't, O'Connell replied quickly. You have the power to send U.S. forces into any part of the world that you want. In O'Connell's mind, Congress had given the Pentagon broad authorities to carry out a global war to gather intelligence or launch killing operations, and Rumsfeld ought to use them. He saw parallels to the Vietnam War when President Nixon started a secret bombing campaign in Cambodia and Laos because he believed those countries had become safe havens for enemy fighters. But the difference, O'Connell thought, was that Rumsfeld had even more authority than Nixon had, because now Congress had essentially given the Pentagon its blessing to send troops wherever it believed al-Qaeda fighters were hiding. At the time, Rumsfeld was also looking for leverage in his fights with the CIA, and he decided to consolidate all of the military's disparate and often haphazard intelligence-gathering operations into one office. He tapped his loyal aide Stephen Cambone as the first Under Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, giving the brainy and prickly Cambone extraordinary power to oversee all Pentagon spying efforts. Rumsfeld would even revamp the civilian line of succession in the Pentagon hierarchy in the event he and his deputy died or were incapacitated. Cambone, the intelligence chief, was put next in line and given an office right next to Rumsfeld's. Rumsfeld appointed as Cambone's deputy Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin, a Delta Force veteran who had been in the Iranian desert in 1980 during the botched operation to rescue the American hostages. Boykin was a born-again Christian who wore religion on his sleeve and occasionally spoke about the war against Muslim extremists in biblical terms. He often called it a war against Satan, and once told a church congregation that in the early 1990s, he knew that his hunt for a Somali warlord would be successful because he knew that his God was a real God and the Somalis was an idol. Boykin was also evangelical about pushing the military to the edge of its legal authorities. Since the Beirut hostage crises of the 1980s, he had been frustrated that Pentagon bureaucrats had been too timid about making use of groups like Delta Force. As he did with O'Connell, Rumsfeld peppered Boykin with questions during his job interview about the limits of the Defense Secretary's authorities to send troops outside of war zones. Boykin gave a similar response as O'Connell had. You have the authority and you ought to use it. You don't need to put your troops under the control of the CIA. Rumsfeld got a boost in his efforts to build an empire for unconventional warfare in the summer of 2004 when the 9/11 Commission recommended in its final report that the CIA be stripped of all of its paramilitary functions and that the Pentagon serve as the only agency carrying out clandestine warfare. The Commission had excoriated the CIA for its inability to kill Osama bin Laden and thought that the agency's clandestine operations were in disarray. The panel recommended that the CIA improve intelligence collection with less reliance on foreign spy services, overhaul the way it conducted analysis, and perform non-military covert actions, like propaganda campaigns. Secret wars and drone strikes, the commission believed, were the job of the Pentagon. Whether the price is measured in either money or people, the United States cannot afford to build two separate capabilities for carrying out secret military operations, secretly operating standoff missiles and secretly training foreign military or paramilitary forces, recommended the commission in its final report, published in July 2004. That, of course, was exactly what Rumsfeld thought. And days after the report was released, he asked Tom O'Connell to get more information about what led to the recommendation. After speaking with John Layman, the former Navy Secretary and a 9/11 commissioner, O'Connell reported back that the commission had found the CIA's approach to paramilitary operations muddled. In a memo to Rumsfeld, O'Connell wrote that Lehman had told him the 9/11 Commission was struck by the CIA's unwillingness to take risk and the fact that the agency was reluctant to pull the trigger when opportunities were presented. The biggest problem, Lehman had told O'Connell, was that the Pentagon had the capabilities for hunting and killing operations, but the CIA had the authorities. Rumsfeld put Cambone in charge of investigating whether this recommendation could be enacted, and soon Cambone was asking deeper questions about whether CIA operations should be pared down even further. In late September 2004, Cambone wrote to Rumsfeld that he wasn't sure it made sense for the CIA to be carrying out any covert action, which he said could be viewed as an operational activity not unlike that of a combatant commander. In other words, maybe the Pentagon should be taking over covert action as well. The problem, Cambone wrote, was that the CIA was in charge of both covert action and analysis, creating the potential for bias when assessing the efficacy of a specific covert action. Put differently, the CIA was set up to grade its own work. The point might have been self-serving, but it got to the heart of a more profound question. Can an agency in charge of a targeted killing campaign against Al-Qaeda provide dispassionate assessments about the impact that very campaign was having on the strength of Al-Qaeda? It was a question Obama officials would face years later after the spy agency escalated its drone war in Pakistan. In the end, both Rumsfeld and CIA Director Porter Goss advised President Bush that the Pentagon didn't need to wrest secret military operations away from the CIA. Rumsfeld had become convinced that he could do what he wanted, even if the CIA was doing it in parallel, under the banner of traditional military activities. Goss had also waged a quiet lobbying campaign to protect the CIA's turf, urging White House officials not to consider the 9/11 Commission's recommendation. It was a temporary moment of agreement for the Pentagon and CIA, and hardly an end to the battles between the two agencies. Already by 2004, small teams of JSOC operatives had begun fanning out on spying missions across the globe, to South America and Africa and Asia and the Middle East. They went to France to try to gather intelligence about Islamic militant groups there, and one team had to leave Paraguay in a hurry after one of Rumsfeld's spies pulled a gun in the middle of a bar fight. As one former Pentagon official who helped oversee the program put it, "We had all these guys running around trying to be James Bond, and it didn't work very well." Some of the teams, given the innocuous-sounding name Military Liaison Elements, were stationed inside American embassies. Others stealthily entered foreign countries and began their spying missions without notifying the American ambassador or CIA station chief in the country. Because the whole world was now a war zone, Pentagon officials figured the special operations teams would answer to military commanders, not to the civilian ambassador. One afternoon, the American ambassador to Jordan, Edward W. Ghanim, was sitting in his office when the embassy's defense attaché walked in and put a note on his desk. It was a message from the Pentagon, sent directly to the attaché and meant for only him to see. A military intelligence team would soon be arriving in Jordan, the note read, and the team would be gathering information about the stability of the Jordanian regime. By no means, the message read, were the ambassador or the CIA station chief to be told about the Pentagon's activities in Jordan. The defense attaché sitting in the ambassador's office had, of course, ignored this admonition. After the meeting, Ghanim promptly told the CIA station chief, who, as Ghanim remembered it, hit the roof. Chapter 5. The Angry Bird. A quote from Lieutenant Colonel John Paul Vann, American officer in Vietnam. This is a political war, and it calls for discrimination in killing. The best weapon for killing would be a knife, but I'm afraid we can't do it that way. The worst is an airplane. Officers inside the operations room at the CIA's counter-terrorist center watched video of the Toyota Land Cruiser bumping over the desert road in Yemen's Marib province, the legendary birthplace of the Queen of Sheba. It was an uncomfortable ride for the six men crammed into the dusty 4x4, but nothing about the truck typically would have raised suspicions among Yemeni police or soldiers on that day in November 2002. But from the back seat of the truck, a cell phone belonging to Qaid Salim Sinan al-Harithi was betraying the location of the most wanted man in Yemen. An armed CIA predator was flying overhead. The United States had fingered al-Harithi as the mastermind of the 2000 bombing of the destroyer USS Cole, an attack that killed 17 sailors as the ship was refueling in the Gulf of Aden. The attack had put al-Harithi near the top of the Bush administration's list of al-Qaeda operatives marked for death, and when a team of American Special Operations troops landed in Yemen in the spring of 2002, they made hunting al-Harithi a priority. But al-Harithi was a veteran of the Mujahideen War in Afghanistan during the 1980s, and whatever survival skills he hadn't learned while battling the Soviets, he had honed during a decade of hiding from the secret police in the United Arab Emirates and from the shock troops loyal to Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh. In 2000, Osama bin Laden had sent al-Harithi to Yemen to plan the Cole bombing and to set up al-Qaeda training camps. More than once, al-Harithi had embarrassed President Saleh by escaping capture just as Yemeni troops were closing in. The mercurial Saleh had immediately seen the financial benefits of siding with the United States in its new war, but had insisted that the Bush administration do it on his terms. He had managed to stay in power in Yemen since the 1970s by navigating the shoals of tribal blood feuds and Shiite separatists, and he wasn't about to let Americans begin a stealth war in his country without getting something in return. On a trip to Washington 2 months after the September 11 attacks, he managed to wrangle $400 million in aid during meetings with President Bush, Rumsfeld, and CIA Director George Tenet. He gave his blessing to a small group of American Special Operations troops coming to Yemen, but insisted that they fire weapons only in self-defense. Without telling Saleh, the Pentagon also sent operatives from Gray Fox, the Army spying unit that specialized in intercepting communications, along with the commandos. And yet Saleh had been an easy sell when it came to the Predator. In spring 2002, Ambassador Edmund Hall requested a meeting to get the Yemeni president to agree to drone flights in the country. By then, Hall knew Saleh well enough to know about his wild mood swings and what talking points might best advance the spy agency's case. A group of CIA officers who had arrived from Langley days earlier brought a laptop computer with an animated video demonstrating how the drones worked. The video included graphics of Hellfire missiles hitting cars and mud compounds. Saleh broke into a smile as he watched, and he seemed proud that Yemen would be the first place outside of Afghanistan that the CIA was preparing to use the Predator. But the Americans still had to find al-Harithi, who eluded surveillance by switching between 5 different cell phone numbers. The Gray Fox team had identified several of them, but al-Harithi was always careful enough to use the phones sparingly. On November 4th, however, the surveillance net got its first big catch. The cell phone in the back of the Land Cruiser was beaming its signal into the skies, and Gray Fox operatives sent a flash message to analysts at the National Security Agency's sprawling headquarters at Fort Meade, Maryland. Separately, the CIA had dispatched an armed Predator from its drone base in Djibouti just across the Red Sea from Yemen. As the Predator moved into position above the land cruiser, an analyst at Fort Meade heard Al-Harithi's voice over the cell phone, barking directions to the driver of the 4x4. With confirmation that Al-Harithi was in the truck, the CIA was now authorized to fire a missile at the vehicle. The missile came off the Predator drone and destroyed the truck, killing everyone inside. Qaid Salim Sinan Al-Harithi was eventually identified in the rubble by a distinguishing mark on one of his legs, which was found at the scene, severed from his body. President Saleh's government was quick to issue a cover story. The truck had been carrying a canister of gas that triggered an explosion, but inside the counter-terrorist center, the importance of the moment was not lost. It was the first time since the September 11 attacks that the CIA had carried out a targeted killing outside a declared war zone. Using the sweeping authority President Bush had given to the CIA in September 2001, clandestine officers had methodically gathered information about Al-Harithi's movements and then coolly incinerated his vehicle with an anti-tank missile. By this time, many inside the spy agency had forgotten that the CIA had never really wanted the armed drone. It had been considered a blunt and unsophisticated killing tool, and many at the CIA were glad that the agency had gotten out of the assassination business long ago. Little more than a year before the Yemen strike, a debate was still raging as spies fought with spies about the morality of using drones to kill terrorists. Charles E. Allen, a longtime CIA analyst and a fierce advocate for the Predator, would later describe the whole period as a bloody struggle. By the late 1990s, Ross Newland's generation of CIA officers, who had joined the agency after the revelations of the Church Committee and President Ford's ban on assassinations, had ascended to leadership positions at Langley. The rise to power of the post-Church generation had a direct impact on the type of clandestine operations the CIA chose to conduct around the world. The agency's paramilitary branch had been allowed to wither, a reflection of the CIA's antipathy toward returning to the wars of the past. The CIA was even divided about whether it could justifiably kill Osama bin Laden. One former head of the Counterterrorist Center would later tell the 9/11 Commission that he would have refused a direct order to kill bin Laden in the years before the September 11 attacks. The corporate view inside CIA was, we don't want to do covert action, and if we do covert action, we want it to be neat and clean. We don't want to be involved in killing people, because we're not like that. We're not Mossad, said Richard Clark, who served in both the Clinton and Bush administrations as the top White House official responsible for counterterrorism. By 2000, the year that Newland left undercover operations in the field for a senior management job at Langley as a CIA liaison to the Pentagon, bin Laden had repeatedly shown he could strike at the time and place of his choosing, from the American embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 to the attack on the coal in Yemen 2 years later. The Clinton administration had few good ideas when it came to figuring out where the Al-Qaeda leader was at any given time and then killing him before he went somewhere else. Inside the White House Situation Room, discussions about bin Laden turned into abstract debates about whether the White House might be violating the 1976 ban on assassinations by choosing one killing method over another. Clark remembered one meeting when National Security Advisor Sandy Berger became so enraged by the debates, he shouted at everyone in the room. He said, "So, you guys are perfectly okay if Bill Clinton kills bin Laden with a Tomahawk missile, but if Bill Clinton kills him with a 7.62-millimeter round in the middle of the eyes, that's bad? Could you tell me the difference between killing him with a Tomahawk and an M-16? Berger was about to have a heart attack, said Clark. He was all sweaty and red in the face and yelling at them. President Clinton wasn't amused by the lack of options. You know, Clinton told Joint Chiefs Chairman General Hugh Shelton, it would scare the shit out of Al-Qaeda if suddenly a bunch of black ninjas rappelled out of helicopters into the middle of their camp. Not having ninjas at its disposal, the Pentagon had agreed to station two submarines in the Arabian Sea that could fire Tomahawk cruise missiles into Afghanistan on short notice. But without fresh intelligence about bin Laden's whereabouts, the submarines were of little use, and top admirals began agitating to move them elsewhere. The CIA had one Taliban source feeding information to the Americans, but his tips were usually 24 hours old, insufficient for White House approval of missile strikes into Afghanistan. Flailing for ideas, clandestine officers met with American defense contractors about building blimps or hot air balloons to take pictures of Afghanistan at 30,000 feet, but scrapped the idea when they considered the diplomatic calamity if wind gusts from the Hindu Kush Mountains were to push a blimp hundreds of miles off course and into China, possibly over a nuclear reactor. Clark had a frosty relationship with George Tenet and James Pavitt, the head of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, and decided to go around them for new ideas. He called senior CIA analyst Charles E. Allen, who had been at the agency for four decades and, by then, was in his mid-60s. Bright, iconoclastic, and ornery, Allen bore scars from the agency's past battles. The Iran-Contra scandal had dealt his career a glancing blow, but he had also emerged as something of a legend among CIA analysts for being a lonely voice in 1990, predicting that Saddam Hussein would invade Kuwait. Clark asked Allen to conduct an independent review of various options for spying in Afghanistan. Allen went to the Defense Department for ideas and met with officers working for the Pentagon's joint staff. They discussed far-fetched ideas, such as putting a giant telescope on a mountaintop and training it on bin Laden's Darunta training camp near Jalalabad, where Al-Qaeda had experimented with chemical weapons. But there was another, more realistic option. Allen was told about a series of secret tests the Air Force had been conducting in the desert. There was a chance, Pentagon officials said, that the CIA could find bin Laden using a drone. By 2000, the MQ-1 Predator was well known inside the small, geeky fraternity of military engineers and intelligence analysts working at the experimental fringes of electronic spying. The Predator had already had some success as a spying tool in the Balkan Wars, spotting Serbian troop concentrations and hunting Bosnian Serb leaders. Drone pilots operated the planes out of a hangar in Albania that the CIA had rented in exchange for two truckloads of wool blankets. The drone video was beamed into the office of CIA Director R. James Woolsey, Jr., who communicated with the pilots through a crude email link. Woolsey had managed to get a small stash of money to fund the project from Representative Charlie Wilson, the hard-drinking Texas congressman who had used similar budget trickery to fund the CIA's war in Afghanistan during the 1980s. The mountainous terrain in the Balkans had made it impossible to fly the drones using line-of-sight technology, with the pilot operating the drone through a direct signal to the airplane. So during the 1990s, the military had made strides flying the Predators by bouncing a signal off a satellite hurtling through space. But the Predator couldn't carry a weapon. It also looked like a gangly insect and had a loud engine that made it sound like a flying lawnmower. Unlike most planes, its stabilizers pointed down rather than thrusting up into the sky. And when one major trade magazine published its first story about the Predator, the photo was upside down. But a handful of Air Force officers inside the service's flyboy culture saw the potential in unmanned systems and began advocating for the Predator. Allen brought the Predator idea back to Richard Clark at the White House. They figured that both Tenet and Pavitt would be against the idea, so they waited to tell them about the Predator option until a plan had been cobbled together to send the Predator into Afghanistan. Without telling Tenet, Clark called a White House meeting and invited the Predator's biggest advocates, Charlie Allen, CTC Chief Kofor Black, and Richard Blee, the head of the CTC's Bin Laden hunting unit, which had been given the code name Alex Station. Blee was a career case officer who had served in several CIA stations in Africa, and shortly after he took over Alex Station in 1999, he led a team into Afghanistan's Panjshir Valley to reestablish CIA contact with Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, whom al-Qaeda would end up killing just 2 days before the September 11 attacks. Blee was smart and intense, but occasionally sullen, leading some of his colleagues to think of him as aloof. He had grown up a CIA brat, the son of a head of the CIA's Soviet division who had battled with the agency's legendary head of counterintelligence, James Angleton, over the direction of clandestine operations against the Soviet Union. David Blee won the fight and successfully penetrated the KGB with dozens of highly placed moles during the 1970s. Now his son was at the front of a very different CIA war. By Memorial Day weekend 2000, Clinton's national security advisor Sandy Berger thought that the CIA had dickered around too long about the Predator and demanded a decision on the drone flights. General John Gordon, the CIA's deputy director, arranged a hasty meeting at Langley that quickly degenerated into a shouting match. Pavitt, who by then had been told about the Predator option, made it clear he opposed having CIA spy flights over Afghanistan. "Where would the drones be based?" he asked. "And what if they were shot down?" "The CIA shouldn't be operating its own air force," Pavitt said. The meeting, one participant said, became a really ugly scene. After the session, Allen called Clark to tell him about Pavitt's opposition. Clark thought Pavitt's worries were ludicrous and that the plan presented almost zero risk. "You know," he told Allen, "if the Predator gets shot down, the pilot goes home and fucks his wife. It's okay. There's no POW issue here." Tenet was also skeptical when he heard about the Predator days later, and he didn't relish the prospect of asking Uzbekistani strongman Islam Karimov to allow the CIA to base Predators at an old Soviet airbase near the Afghan border. At the time, the idea of the CIA establishing military-style bases anywhere in the world seemed crazy, and a drain on the agency's limited budget for covert action. By June, however, Clark had won the argument, and the White House had approved moving Predators to the Karshi-Khanabad Air Base in Uzbekistan. But CIA officers had another problem: how to get enough satellite bandwidth for the drone flights. Air Force engineers by that point had devised a way to fly the Predator from thousands of miles away by bouncing the signal off a satellite and relaying the feed through a ground station in Germany. This allowed the CIA to station Predator pilots very close to home in a converted race car trailer set up in a parking lot at Langley. But the agency still had to rent bandwidth from commercial satellite companies, which proved harder than expected. With news organizations sucking up all of the satellite bandwidth in their preparations to cover the Olympic Games in Sydney, the Predators were almost grounded as the CIA frantically searched for a satellite company with transponder space to rent. The spying flights began in September 2000, and the CIA flew more than a dozen drone missions over Afghanistan in the fall before the winter winds in the mountains began buffeting the Predator's fragile airframe, making the flights too risky. Several times, Clark drove out to Langley to watch the video beamed into the trailer in the parking lot. "It was just science fiction. It was unbelievable," he said. During one flight over Bin Laden's Tarnak Farms training camp near Kandahar, the Predator spotted a truck convoy driving into the camp. out walked a tall man in long white robes. The video was grainy, but every person standing around the video monitor at the CIA was convinced that the camera was trained on bin Laden. CIA analysts scrambled to alert the Pentagon and the White House to get approval to launch missiles from the submarines. But officials at the National Security Council demanded to know whether bin Laden was going to be at Tarnak Farms for at least 6 hours, the time it would take to go through the launch protocols, and for the Tomahawk missiles to fly from a submarine in the Arabian Sea to southern Afghanistan. The CIA had no clue, and so Sandy Berger and his staff declined to approve the strike. The CIA had only two options: predict bin Laden's whereabouts 6 hours in advance, or find a weapon that could hunt the Al-Qaeda leader and kill him immediately. Indian Springs Air Force Auxiliary Field was at the time a small, decaying base in the Nevada desert, some 35 miles northwest of Las Vegas. It was one of a myriad of benighted military outposts built during World War II and then forgotten by the Pentagon. In the 1950s and 60s, the base had been a supply hub for the underground nuclear tests nearby, and helicopters stationed at Indian Springs were occasionally flown over the test sites at Mercury and Yucca Flats to monitor for radiation leaks. Save for the occasional training by the Thunderbirds, the Air Force's demonstration squadron, Indian Springs was a desolate backwater. The base also had a bird problem. The skies above Indian Springs were filled with birds, and the Air Force had restricted how often fighter jets could take off from the base due to concerns that the birds could get sucked into jet engines and cause deadly crashes. But as a drone proving ground, Indian Springs was ideal. The aircraft didn't fly much faster than the birds. At Indian Springs, a small group of test pilots was trying to turn the Predator from a hunter into a killer. The housing at the base was scheduled for demolition because the walls of the bungalows were filled with asbestos, so the Predator team traveled each morning from their rented houses in the Las Vegas suburbs to a command post set up at Indian Springs inside an abandoned church building. Kurt Hawes, one of the Predator pilots at the base in 2000 and 2001, recalls that his group had a vague idea that the drone testing had been accelerated because the CIA urgently wanted to use the Predator to kill bin Laden. But most of the details about the debate back in Washington were kept from the group at the base. Funding for the program had been channeled through the Air Force's Big Safari Office, a classified division based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, in charge of developing secret intelligence programs for the military. Big Safari's mandate was to cut through Pentagon bureaucracy to get certain weapons from the drawing board to the field more quickly than usual, which sometimes meant that they went into combat before they were entirely ready. Such was the case in 2000 with the early model Predators, aircraft with a haphazard control panel that some pilots likened to the scattered features of a Mr. Potato Head doll. Just one of the significant design flaws was that the button that killed the engine on the drone was only a quarter inch from the button that launched the Hellfire missile, creating the possibility for human error with deadly consequences. The bigger problem, however, was that nobody was quite sure what launching the missile might do to the drone itself. Would the force of the missile rupture the airframe or rip the Predator's wings in mid-flight? In January 2001, a test was conducted in the high desert of China Lake, California, to find out. 3 days after President Bush was sworn into office, Air Force engineers chained a Predator to a concrete pad on top of a small mountain and fired a Hellfire missile from the drone. The missile hit a target tank in its path, and the Predator was undamaged. Live flight tests could proceed. Hours before dawn on February 16, 2001, Kurt Hawes left the command post in the abandoned church at Indian Springs and drove 20 miles into the desert. He had gone over the pre-flight checklist in his mind the night before, sitting in his bedroom in Las Vegas. His eyes closed, he practiced the moves his hands would make as he controlled the Predator joystick and fired a missile. Maybe for the first time in the history of American flight, the drama surrounding a landmark test had nothing to do with concerns about whether the pilot would survive. Kurt Hawes didn't wake up on the morning of February 16th as Chuck Yeager had before he squeezed into the cockpit of the Bell X-1, hoping he wouldn't be the latest test pilot to die trying to break the sound barrier. Hawes faced no risk whatsoever, which is exactly why it was a watershed moment. The United States was developing a new weapon for war that required no one actually going to war. The test was planned for early morning when the desert winds would be calmest. Shortly after sunrise, Hawes took control of the Predator from the team that had launched the drone off the runway at Indian Springs. He slowly made it descend to 2,000 feet, the highest altitude from which a Hellfire missile had ever been fired. He lined up the shot with the help of a laser beam pointed at a target tank in the desert, the laser directed by an army contractor on the ground. Pressing the button, he launched the Hellfire missile. What Hawes remembers was the silence. He was a pilot, but he was miles away from his plane. He couldn't hear the sound of the Hellfire's rocket engine firing or feel the plane buffet when he launched the missile. His video screen flickered from the missile's heat trail, and he watched the missile propel toward the target tank for a direct hit. The engineers had decided not to use a live warhead for the test, so there was no explosion. The dummy missile struck the tank's turret 6 inches to the right of dead center, denting the armor and spinning the turret 30 degrees. The test was declared an unqualified success. By 7 a.m., it was done, and the Predator team met at the little casino adjacent to the Indian Springs base for a celebratory breakfast. Air Force leaders were giddy, and by the second test, 5 days later, they had arranged for a group of generals to gather at the Pentagon to watch the Hellfire shot through a video feed sent from Nevada. This time, Kurt Hawes flew the Predator using a satellite, creating a 2-second lag between his joystick movements and the actual movements of the plane. This made the Predator more difficult to control, but once again, the Hellfire scored a direct hit. This time, the missile carried a live warhead, and when it found its target, a small ball of fire rose into the morning sky. The age of armed, remote-controlled conflict had begun with little fanfare. The Air Force issued a short press release, which led to a small story in a local Las Vegas newspaper. A congressman from Nevada called to congratulate the Predator team, but the engineers and pilots were disappointed when a CNN crew that was rumored to be coming to film the test didn't show up. CIA officials had been trying to keep the entire operation a secret and were angry that the Air Force even put out a press release. CNN was never allowed on base. Kurt Hawes didn't know any of these details. All he heard was that other parties had intervened to keep his work a secret. But those other parties couldn't decide what to do with the armed drone. Even after the successful missile tests, the CIA remained divided at the top about whether to send armed Predators to Afghanistan to hunt for Osama bin Laden. Pavitt, head of the CIA's clandestine service, was a one-man Greek chorus arguing forcefully against the CIA running the Predator program. He wanted to spend his black budget on hiring more case officers, not buying drones. He would repeatedly ask a question during meetings that now seems quaint after the billions of dollars that have poured into counterterrorism programs since the September 11 attacks. Was the $2 million for each Predator going to come out of the CIA or the Pentagon budget? But he also voiced a much deeper concern, one shared by other members of Tenet's staff. What exactly were the repercussions of the CIA getting back into assassinations? You can't underestimate the cultural change that comes with gaining lethal authority, said John McLaughlin, then the CIA's deputy director. When people say to me it's not a big deal, I say to them, have you ever killed anyone? He said. It is a big deal. You start thinking about things differently. Moreover, the United States was scolding other countries for the exact same thing it was debating whether to undertake. When Israel's government was killing off Hamas leaders in 2000 and 2001 during the Second Palestinian Intifada, American Ambassador to Israel Martin Indyk said that the United States is very clearly on the record as being against targeted assassinations. They are extrajudicial killings, and we do not support that. George Tenet was ambivalent and repeatedly said he thought it should be the military, not the CIA, that pulled the trigger on a weapon of war. During one discussion about whether a CIA officer should be allowed to authorize predator strikes, both Charles Allen and Alvin Buzzy Krongard, the agency's third-ranking official, volunteered to pull the trigger themselves. This infuriated Tenet. He later told the 9/11 Commission he scolded Allen and Krongard, telling them they had no authority to fire a Hellfire missile, and neither did he. Sitting near Tenet's side during all the debates about the Predator, Lieutenant General John Campbell was a bit like an anthropologist watching the fighting rituals of a strange species. He had spent his career in the Air Force and had moved to Langley the previous summer to take over as the agency's director of military support. Campbell believed strongly that the CIA should embrace the Predator. But now, when he thinks back to the internal fights over armed drones in the summer of 2001, he understands that the agency was wrestling with the most basic questions about what it wanted to be. In the military culture, if you're following a legal order, and as an officer you're expected to follow a legal order, then you're pretty much protected in the long term for any personal liability for the things you do, he said. The CIA is different. They have much less protection. They can be operating under the provisions of a presidential finding where you get a piece of paper with a president's signature that says, I authorize you to do these things. Then the next administration can come in and justice decides that the finding was questionable and maybe even illegal. And guess what? Those guys are personally liable for the things they did. Something like the Predator, where you're specifically targeting individuals, dredges up a whole list of concerns about the future ramifications, said Campbell. Campbell's deputy at the time was Ross Newland, who had a front-row seat for the Predator fights. As he sat in the meetings, Newland knew he was watching another turn of the familiar cycle. A risk-averse CIA was once again about to wade back into secret war. He supported the Predator program and thought that the Bush administration should use it to kill bin Laden as soon as possible. But he also couldn't help but think back to his days as a counter-narcotics officer in Bolivia. An unprepared CIA had been assigned the mission of chasing drug runners because nobody else wanted to do it. 2 decades later, Newland could see the same thing happening with terrorism. Weeks later, when the September 11 attacks killed nearly 3,000 Americans, thorny questions about assassination, covert action, and the proper use of the CIA in hunting America's enemies were quickly swept aside. Within weeks, the CIA began conducting dozens of drone strikes in Afghanistan. America had found, in the armed Predator, the ultimate weapon for a secret war. It was a tool that killed quietly, a weapon unbound by the normal rules of accountability in combat. Armed drones would allow American presidents to order strikes on remote villages and desert camps where journalists and independent monitoring groups could not go. The strikes were rarely discussed publicly by a spokesman standing at a podium, but they were cheered in private by politicians from both parties, hoping to flex American muscle without putting American lives at risk. Rare is the technology that can change the face of warfare. In the first half of the past century, tanks and planes transformed how the world fought its battles. The 50 years that followed were dominated by nuclear warheads and ICBMs, weapons of such horrible power that they gave birth to new doctrines that keep countries from ever using them. The advent of the armed drone upended this calculus. War was possible exactly because it seemed so free of risk. The bar for war had been lowered, the remote-controlled age had begun, and the killer drones became an object of fascination inside the CIA. During the summer of 2002, Ross Newland visited the small gift shop at the CIA's headquarters. Looking to buy some presents for friends, he walked amid the rows of shelves filled with mugs, fleece jackets, and T-shirts emblazoned with the CIA logo. Then he made an unexpected find, a golf shirt with a small drone embroidered on the left side. The Predator still was one of the CIA's most classified programs, but the spy agency was now hawking images of the drones on souvenirs. The killing of al-Harithi in Yemen later that year showed that the CIA, with a pliable foreign ally, could wage war far beyond war zones. Bush officials were so pleased about the strike in Yemen that news of the attack quickly leaked out, puncturing the thin cover story put out by Yemeni officials about the exploding gas can. Paul Wolfowitz, deputy defense secretary, even praised the strike on CNN. President Saleh was furious when he heard about Wolfowitz's comments. His government had been made to look like fools and liars, and he demanded that American spies and diplomats in Yemen appear in his office immediately. Since Washington couldn't keep a secret, he told them, America's hidden war in Yemen would be scaled back. He ordered the Predator flights to stop immediately. And they did, for nearly 8 years. It wouldn't be until 2010, with Yemen in turmoil and Saleh losing his grip on power one finger at a time, that another American president would order drones back over the skies of Yemen. By then, Saleh was hardly in any position to object. Chapter 6. A True Pashtun. A quote by Pervez Musharraf. Things fall out of the sky all the time. Why is this bird following me? Nek Muhammad Wazir sat inside a mud building in South Waziristan, surrounded by his followers and talking on his satellite phone to a BBC reporter. Looking out the window, the young commander with long jet-black hair noticed something hovering above, glinting in the sun. He asked one of his lieutenants about the coruscating metal object in the sky. Nek Muhammad had just humbled Pakistani troops, and the CIA was following him. He had emerged as the undisputed rock star of Pakistan's tribal areas, a brash member of the Wazir tribe who had raised an army to fight government forces in the spring of 2004 and brought Islamabad to the negotiating table. His rise had taken Pakistan's leaders by surprise, and now they wanted him dead. Nek Muhammad, age 29, was part of a second generation of Pakistani mujahideen who saw no cause for loyalty to the ISI that had given succor to their fathers during the war against the Soviets. Many Pakistanis in the tribal areas viewed President Musharraf's alliance with Washington after the September 11 attacks with disdain, and saw the Pakistani military